Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Heart Talk with Miss E. For our broadcast tonight, being February 7th, the first Tuesday in the month of Heart. You know, this is my favorite month of the year. Everybody gets excited over Christmas, but I get excited over Valentine's and the opportunity to pick up every heart there is in the grocery store and any other store. And golly, the day after Valentine's, I'm in heart heaven because I collect all of my hearts for the year. But on another note of the heart tonight, the topic of discussion is where's the love, peace, and soul, the impact of mental illness in the African-American community. As many of you know, that the African-American community and the community at large globally has had the passing of someone who has literally come into our homes over the past 30-plus years through the name of a program dear to our hearts, the Soul Train. And we know that Mr. Don Cornelius passed earlier last week and is said to have taken his own life. And interestingly enough, we had already scheduled this program under a slightly different title, talking about the impact of mental illness on our children. For our regular listeners, you know that our focus here is dealing with the youth in the foster care system and the impact that mental health has on those who have ended up in positions of being caretakers for their sometimes mentally ill biological parents, for those who, if the truth be told, have ended up in foster homes of some who are mentally ill and gone untreated, and then for the youth themselves who have been struggling with what I believe are more so emotional issues as wounds from the trauma that they've experienced. But there's the news that we've heard lately about the overuse of psychotropic medications in the foster care system. So we have a real loaded topic tonight, and I'm so excited to have both our guests. One is a personal friend and colleague, Ms. Cheryl Mims, who is now about to receive her doctorate. She's a candidate for her doctorate. And with her dissertation being Family Madness, the Impact of Mental Illness for Children. And I don't have my notes in front of me, Cheryl, but you can correct me when I introduce you. But Cheryl is a licensed clinical social worker here in our little town of Vallejo, California, and she has been in private practice for several years now with combined experience of working in Department of Corrections. Welcome, Cheryl.
Thank you.
Yes. And the next young lady is someone that was just an angel sent to me. And I must say that Cheryl has been my sister friend therapist through a lot of my ups and downs. But Ms. Perry is someone that I literally met through Essence Magazine. And her sharing her just awesome story brought me to tears into the typewriter. And I immediately wrote her. And we have been connected ever since. Ms. Perry is the founder and director of the Stay Strong Foundation. She also is the author of several books, my favorite being The Plentiful Harvest, but also her most current book entitled Black Pain, It Just Looks Like We're Not Hurting. Welcome, Terry.
Well, I'm so very happy to be with you. Thank you
yeah.
for having me. We can't talk enough about this topic.
Mm-hmm. No, we surely can't. We really can't. And I think one of the things most that comes out is that it's something that we have to talk about. When we discuss it, it's usually kept in sort of hush-hush terms or from places of embarrassment or secrecy. So one of the first things I want to ask, we talk about mental health, but usually when we're seeking, you know, mental health services, it's because there's this stigma and the reality that there could be some illness involved. So what is it, and I'm talking to both of you now, what does it mean when we talk about mental health versus mental illness?
I was just finding out in part of my study that I'm doing is that we make different distinctions between the titles of counseling and therapy. And part of my research found out when someone said they're going to counseling, it just meant that you were going to talk to someone. But if you use the term psychotherapy, it meant that you were crazy. And so we just have to I think there's some just confusion about what does it mean when we're just seeking counseling. And I think all these terms, mental health and mental illness, are kind of interchangeable. And we just don't really have a clear distinction in terms of what they mean, but they're all kind of in the ballpark, I think.
So what is the message that we need to give our community in general about mental illness?
Yeah, well, I would one of the things I would say is to get a checkup from the neck up. That's one of the things Reverend Calvin Butts in New York always says. But I think the most important thing for me is that we are nothing without our mental and emotional health. Because if we don't deal with that, we keep making the same mistakes, going round and round and round and round, and we never get out of that unless we know who we are. We don't know what the signs of depression are, what it looks like, what it feels like, what it sounds like. And so I think it's really, really important for us to, and the other thing I think is that we have to share our stories with each other. That's where the healing begins. Our Stay Strong Foundation launched a campaign with the Ad Council a year and a half ago, and we got about $4 million worth of advertising donated to the campaign. But there are real people sharing their stories, young men who were members of the Blood. Susan Taylor, former editor-in-chief of Essence Magazine, speaks about standing in front of thousands of people, speaking with a smile pasted on her face, but dying on the inside. And so it's to just recognize that everybody is going through something. We have all inherited the unresolved pain and wounds and scars of our parents. And so it shapes how we move through the world. And when we don't deal with our stuff, it comes out in a whole lot of different ways. We self-medicate with drugs, with alcohol, with food, work, promiscuous, unprotected sex, shopping when we don't have any money, gambling. Those are all, we will do anything to not feel the real pain that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, you know? And then one thing that I thought about, Evelyn, was when you said that Don Cornelius passed away, but then you said that he took his own life, and I think it's important for us to call it what it is. So I was glad when you said that, because I've been hearing people say Don Cornelius passed away. No, he did not pass away. Mm-hmm. He took his own life. We call that suicide. He committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And I think that as an extraordinary mark that he left for us with Soul Train and the many memories and the joy, that this moment just might be his another part of his legacy in terms of starting or recreating the conversation about how we're really doing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, tonight, the two primary issues that we're going to be talking about are, one, depression, which is, you know, where you're coming from and talking about people bringing up those unspoken feelings. And then we're also talking about the diagnosis that Cheryl's mom received as being schizophrenic. Now, there's a big difference between the two, and one is connected to just being organic, something that's going on internally within the brain and the biochemical. But the other part of the depression can be physical, but I'm also thinking about all the emotional trauma that comes from that. So for someone saying, I'm not crazy, thinking that, okay, you're talking about someone who's just talking and not making sense, any rational sense, or someone who is thinking rationally but not making rational choices. So how would you make that distinction between someone who's resistant to receiving counseling because they don't want the stigma of being crazy?
Well, I think most part when I meet people, all of us, I think, have these internal conversations that go on our head. You know, we chastise ourselves and we make comments like, oh, I don't believe I did that. You know, that was so stupid. Why'd you do that? And so that's totally different from them being able to identify. I am hearing literally voices, auditory hallucinations that is outside of me. And I don't want to share that because, number one, am I really hearing these things? You know, I've been up for a couple of days. Maybe I just don't have enough sleep. Maybe I'm not feeling well. And so we try to attribute different reasons for these voices that I may be hearing. And certainly don't want to talk about them because the first thing is someone is going to say is you are crazy, or I don't want to tell anybody because they're not going to believe me, or if I tell the wrong person, y'all going to hospitalize me. And so there's different fears go around, I believe, in terms of why folks won't admit and speak out loud that I need some help, because I don't know by me disclosing that I need help what are going to be the consequences of me saying that. You know, I might have just been talking and saying, okay, yeah, I hear voices, but I didn't realize that, okay, you guys are going to put me in hospital, you're going to put me on medications, and all these things were going to impact my life, or maybe I can't work anymore. And so there's the fear of, if I do say this, what are the consequences? And the consequences are all unknown to me, so it's just best that I just suffer in silence.
Well, I think for someone who's able to acknowledge that they're hearing voices, but someone, you know, we talk about the delusional thinking as well as the hallucinations, which are not always necessarily a part of depression. We know that there is a state of depression where that type of psychosis can sit in, but for just the average person who's just not feeling, you know, up to par and functioning, what would you say, a family member, to say the difference between, oh, she's just low energy, she's like that anyway, or as you indicated, Terry, in the article about Dr. Evans, his son said, well, he was just a private person. He was just a private person. He just didn't talk much. What would you say to someone who is in that family setting or in that community who just noticed a change in someone's behavior?
Well, I think there are a lot of different approaches. I know that what will get us closer to being healthier, being healthier as individuals, is that wherever, however we can, that we do need to share. I know this sounds a little repetitive, but what I think is important is for us to share with people how we're doing. We've created these circles. We call them the open book, and we're using something that we call like entertainment therapy, like, because laughter is very, very healing. So we might have a comedian, we might have someone who has written and sings a very, very powerful song with using entertainers that you all, whose names you all would know. So and I might share my story that I wrote about in Black Pain. It just looks like we're not hurting. And if you don't believe in therapy or you are unable to afford it, there's no real place for you to go to share how you're really doing. But in a setting like we have created, one person shares their story, and then other people just start to share and talk and cry. When we first launched the Healing Starts With Us campaign, Monique and Terry McMillan and Susan Taylor, Ruby Dee and John Amos, they were all part of our program. And Monique said for the first time publicly that she never said what I'm about to tell you out loud before because she didn't know how people would receive her. But she said, I'm in therapy once a week, and it is the best thing that I have ever done in my life. She would do her concerts, comedy shows, and she would come home, go to her bedroom, and sit in the dark and cry. Mm-hmm. And it was her husband who said to her one day, when we get up tomorrow, we're going to go get you some help. And she just was emphatic about that it saved her life. So we have to begin to tell people in certain kinds of settings, you know, what's really going on. And we got to get rid of the stigma by saying, people say you got to be crazy to go see a therapist. I think that you got to be crazy to not go. With all the childhood stuff and all the stuff that's going on in our lives, you know what I'm saying?
You have to have
an outlet. It's not just the childhood stuff. It's the day-to-day things that happen to us, but because we move at such lightning speed, we don't ever really take the time to process how somebody wounded our spirits, how witnessing a violent episode has impacted on us. We've got to acknowledge those things. Sometimes when I'm sitting in my therapist's office, I'll start talking about something, and all of a sudden the tears will start to flow, and I'm like, I'm surprised at the tears. I'm like, where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
What I realized that it was sitting on my chest all the time, but because I'm moving,
right,
moving, I'm not accessing that.
Exactly. And especially for those of us who I subscribe to the tag as being a wounded healer, that most of us who are in the profession are in the profession because there's a sensitivity within us somewhere, whether we put our finger on it or not. But when we're taking in other people's pain, somewhere, even if it's just a flicker of a thought, when we're working with someone else, some of our own pain is triggered, plus as we're going through our day-to-day circumstances. And when I read your initial article, the part that got to me was the part where you said you would go out and do what you were going to do, and you'd come home and sometimes be in the bed for 2 or 3 days and would get up to listen to the answer machine and just wish you didn't even have to return calls. And I know those days. I start to say I remember those days. I know those days. And the fact that when you're in a particular role that it's not expected that you too would experience those. So who does, you know, the healer go to besides God? And that's a whole other issue, you know, that comes up, especially in the spiritual or religious or Christian community. But I think just that thing to be able to say, yes, I too go through that. Yes, I too have to go to therapy. I remember going to an appointment, you know, through Kaiser and running into one of my clients. And she said, what are you doing here? And I said, getting a tune-up.
That's right.
It's like, I can't take care of you and not take care of me. And I wouldn't ask someone to do something I'm not willing to do myself.
Absolutely.
So,
that's a great story.
Pardon me?
I said, that's a great story.
Yeah.
What you just said, I'm saying, that was a great little interaction there.
And I think that's the part about being real and what makes us also effective as healers, because we can put ourselves in their positions. So I want to hear both your and Cheryl's stories, from coming from a slightly different perspective, with Cheryl being the daughter of someone who was diagnosed with a mental illness, and then you yourself discovering, you know, your own issues with depression. So my questions to both of you, first of all, what were the symptoms and behaviors that came to the forefront initially that caused you to say, you know, I'm not trying to mimic Arsenio Hall, but things that made you say, So Cheryl, what was it that you saw in growing up in your mother, the behaviors that you saw that gave you the indication that something wasn't just right? And then the same thing to you, Terry, just about your own emotions and behaviors.
There were a lot of different things. My mother would be staying up all night, and she'd be cleaning. She was sitting in front of at that time we had this long combination stereo with TV, stereo, and record player in there, and she would sit in front of that thing and just talk to it. One of the things that really struck out about me is the smell. She had this weird smell from her, and it's like, oh, my gosh. And it's ironic because one of her favorite songs was Stevie Wonder, and I don't know why I still like Stevie Wonder today, but I came and just dreaded, because whenever she started playing and singing, and she would cry about him, and it was just all these up and down roller coasters. And so I just remember having an experience like it was kind of like, you know, the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. I never knew when I came home who I was going to meet. And at that time, we didn't have the terms. I never considered my mother crazy. I just thought that something has changed in this woman, and I don't know what it is, and I don't know who she is. And so when she would go to the hospital, she would go away and stay for 6 months, 3 months, or maybe sometime close to a year. But I remember when she came home, she was so different, and I kept saying, what did they do with my mother? Because everything changed. You know, she couldn't drive anymore. She was on medication. She went from a size 5 to a size, 22. So everything really changed. And so we still didn't have any terms because in those days we were calling it a nervous breakdown. And I remember telling my grandmother, well, I want to have one because every time she has one, she goes away. So can I have one too? You know, I need a vacation too. And so that's the term we use. She had a nervous breakdown. Well, that did, I didn't know what that meant. And so it wasn't until I was well into, being adulthood and getting my hours for licensing that I started recognizing and understanding, been able to put together better what exactly was going on with my mother. And so even just now, I would say not so much the schizophrenia part, but I would say definitely, so schizoaffective, because she definitely has the moods. And so those were the symptoms we had to watch out on, the moods, the behavior, the changing. She was very, very nasty when she was in what we call her manic mood, and I didn't like her then because she was cursing, she would hit you, she was very aggressive, she'd get on the phone, she's always trying to call the White House, she would show up at our school. I mean, just all these behaviors were going on. And it was amazing that my brothers and I still had enough sense and discipline to get up in the morning and go to school because, we didn't even get any sleep the night before. So a lot of things were going on and just couldn't pinpoint what was going on with this woman. But it wasn't until a lot later where someone, one of the doctors says, well, your mother is paranoid schizophrenic. And I said, okay. The paranoid I get because it's like, don't go outside, don't answer the phone, everybody's listening, whisper. So the paranoid I got, but I didn't know what the schizophrenia meant. So that didn't really register with me at all. I just knew if she didn't take these pills, we were going to have a really bumpy night.
So she was getting medical attention, but no one was explaining to the family what was going on.
And they could have been. When I was when my mother was diagnosed, I was only like 7 or 8 years old. And so, we wasn't talking to kids. And so the explanation that we got, that they gave my brothers and I was just, your mother just had a nervous breakdown and she just needs to go away. And this was happening more and more frequently. And that's why I asked, well, can I have one too? Because, she'd go away for 6 months. So I would call it, her little
Disneyland
vacations. So no one ever just sat down and explained, this is what's going on with your mother, and these are the things that we can do to maybe alleviate some of these things, but these things are, set and they're just not going to go away. So how are you going to deal with it? My mother had a conservator, and she was really, really wonderful. Had her for like 20 years, and when she showed up, I knew that she was going to make everything right because she was going to take my mother and put her in the hospital. And then, but also knew, too, by her coming, that means my mother was going to go away and I wasn't going to see her for a while. And so it was it was happy on one side, like, yes, here comes the cavalry. she's going to get some help. But on the other hand, it's like, well, I'm not going to see my mother for a while. She's going to be gone.
Wow.
And when she comes back, what is she going to look like this time? It's just a lot of work.
Extended family member and neighbors, because I'm sure other people were looking on from the outside saying, okay, what's up with this? Did you get teased by other kids? Were you embarrassed? Were you afraid?
The only thing, and I think I shared this with you before, the only comment that any kid ever made to me is when I came home from school, I was very active because I was doing things to stay out the house. So I was involved in everything because I didn't want to go home. And so one time I was coming home from school, and this little boy, he told me, he said, your mother was in the middle of the street naked directing traffic. And the only thing that came to my mind was, at least she looked good. Because at that time, she was still just a size 5. So I'm like, and no stretch marks. I said, how do you have 3 babies and no stretch marks anyway? So that's the only thing that I could come back with. And so when you wrote your book about, it's hard work raising the village really raised me. And so we next door to us, we had a sheriff across the street, just everyday regular people. But everybody, unbeknownst to us, were watching out for us. And they would report back to my grandparents, like, those kids are so mild-mannered. You know, they don't have people over there. They're very quiet. And sometimes we just go knock on the door to make sure they're just still breathing. So no one talked about it. Nobody harassed us. It was just like, okay, her mother's different, and they just kept it moving. So I was really surprised about it. But you don't think about it. You just don't think about it. But you know that everybody knows. But you just wasn't talking about it.
Cheryl, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I mean, how many siblings and you all were left alone when she was taken to the hospital?
Well, yeah, in my early years, my dad was in the home. And so when he would go to work, my grandmother would come over in the daytime and watch us, and then my dad would come home in the evening. And so I had two older brothers, and I'm the youngest and the only girl. But then there was a period of time where he wasn't
very,
in the house.
Very interesting, very powerful, and wow, what a story. It made me think about the fact that kids are really, really smart as a whip. Like, they don't miss anything, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it really is so important to explain things to them, you know? And I was just thinking about just the vacuum and you're just nobody sitting you down and really telling you, you know, how really detrimental that is. But it happens all the time. I was talking to someone recently who there was a suicide attempt by the mother, and it was like nobody had taken the time to tell the two sons what had really transpired. So it's not just that she attempted suicide, but that she was going to be in the hospital for a period of time. And they know something. They may not know the specifics, but they know something. And we owe it to our young people to tell them the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And
we just really do.
And the place that I was coming from initially in doing this interview with Cheryl, besides her working on her dissertation and seeking young adults who grew up in homes where they took on the caretaker role or the caregiver role, was that within the foster care system, this is how a lot of our young people come into the foster care system, because there is some form of mental illness going on in the families, which is usually doubled with, some type of addiction, you know, a dual diagnosis as well, and the children end up in the system without being told. Then there are children who slip between the cracks, and sometimes this behavior to them just seems normal. It was just the normal chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall one young man that I had, and when I finally found out what the mom's diagnosis was and got to meet with the birth mom, I started to talk to him about things that happened that he had never told anyone. But I was just throwing out just regular behaviors which are symptomatic of the diagnosis. And he looked at me and said, "How did you know?" But the relief that seemed to have come to that young man, and how he opened up in talking to me, and this was like over a year after I started working with him, that he was now free to talk about some behavior that he or his mom was not going to be judged for, and to be able to educate him on mental illness. And the other part of that is the fear that some children have that they're going to be like their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So that's extremely important. And then I think even from that can come just the basis for the depression, because of the secrecy of holding on something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Cheryl, when I asked you about, you know, what was the community response and the whole part of intervention and treatment. So treatment was taking place, but, again, it was something that the family was not a part of. Their children were not included upon. And that's really sad, because at the same time, sometimes I wonder how many children might not have done as, you know, poorly if they had not gone to the foster care system, because sometimes the foster care system can perpetuate the madness.
Mm-hmm.
So I have lots of mixed feelings about that.
Well, also,
and so how
does
that impact you as an adult? How do you think that role as a child impacted you as an adult?
I think, well, first of all, the one thing I did not want to do was work in the field of mental health. Originally, my goals was to be a psychiatrist, because my father told me I was born talking. And so I'm like, well, I might as well put that to good use. But when I got, and my only view of psychiatry was, you know, just coming to the office and laying on the couch and the Freud theory, just laying out and just people just talking to you. And you just sit there going, And so that was very appealing to me. And it wasn't until I got older, like around high school, that I found out that psychiatry is connected with mental health. And I'm like, oh, no, I can't do that, because if I can't fix my mother, then how am I going to fix other people? Because that was the way I was thinking. And so I shied away from mental health field, but as I found out, God has a sense of humor, and this is what I do for a living now. And so I think the impact for me and how it impacted me is that it gives me, I think, a unique perspective of sitting down and talking with someone and really understanding what's going on, where they're at, and also be able to disclose my own personal experience about growing up with someone who has a mental illness and have a little bit more compassion. But it's also highlighted some things in me. I think I'm just now discovering for myself that growing up, I was a lonely child, and it didn't seem like that because I was out. I was always in sports, did the cheerleading, the track, and volleyball. I did all of that. But when I look back, I was really, really lonely. And even though I had friends, I socialized it. And so I have grown up to call that term what I call the functionally depressed. I function just fine, but underneath there's some depression going on. You know, we work, we go to school, you know, we're wives, we're, you know, coworkers or whatever, but underneath there we have some depression going on, so we're just functioning. And so that's how I kind of saw myself over the years, and I think a bit of it was, and what I felt in myself was a sense of failure, because every time my mom went into the hospital, I took it as a personal failure. Why didn't I do such and such? Why wasn't I able to keep her stable? And just right now as we speak, my mother's been living with me for the last 3 years. And so I'm going through my own personal transition, so I just need to get her, you know, stable and situated. And so I sent her back home, and she's with my brothers. Well, 2 weeks later, she stopped taking her medication. So as of right now, you know, she's in the hospital. And for a couple of days, I was in a funk, and I was kicking myself. Okay, sure, why did you do that? Why didn't you see these adjustments coming on? And that's a big part of a diagnosis, mental diagnosis, that we don't really talk about, we don't really understand, is we go through adjustments. There are all kinds of adjustments, you know, anxiety, depression, or a combination of both. And so with my mother, she went through an adjustment. Yes, she was going home, but she's been in facilities since 2003. And so it was a huge impact, and I'm kicking myself up. Why didn't I anticipate that this would be traumatic for her? I'm just thinking she's going home. It's her house. You know, they've had the house since 1962. She's going home, so she should be okay. But it wasn't okay for her, and she had trouble adjusting. And so I think for me, I have to learn with my mother not to take things personally, that I'm still trying to fix her, and I feel guilty when it doesn't happen or when I feel like I fail her. But that's my own cost to bear. But I think I'm very harsh on myself, because I know the reality is that, you know, if it was just as simple as me feeling a fixer, my mother would only have spent one time in the hospital if it was just that simple. But I understand that it's not. But, you know, I'm human, and so I have these, and I'm very attached to my mother, and I just want her to be okay. But when she's not, I take it as I have failed her in some way, and what can I do to fix it or make it better?
Well, what do you do with your own emotions?
I talk to you. my tendency is to withdraw. Then again, that stems from me growing up at being this lonely child. And so when things were going on, I'd find just somewhere to be, to withdraw and process. And so that's how I still tend to handle things now. When I come out, then I can talk about it. Then I can reconnect with people and say, oh, what's going on, my girl? How much time you got? You got about 2 hours. You know, then. But first for me, I have to process it on my own. And then once I get to a point where, okay, you know, you're just going through the valley, sure. You're just going through a valley. You know, this don't last forever. You know, just keep it moving. Then once I get myself and come out of that, then I can start talking to my sisters like, okay, this is where I was at. This is what's going on. And so that's how I cope. But I believe therapy is a beautiful thing. I suggest all my clients take mental health days. I take them all the time. I do go to comedy shows. I agree with you, Terry. Laughter is beautiful, and I love it. And so that is how I take care of myself, because I tell my clients, if I'm not up to par, then I can't be the best therapist for you. And that's even if I just have a cold. So I have to take care of myself.
Amen.
And I'm going to direct this question to Terry, because I have bordered on both sides of this. It's like when you withdraw on yourself, because interestingly enough, I was an only child for 11 years as well, and dealing with some of my own parental caregiving behaviors. But my question is, one of the things that I felt that probably intensifies depression is that not willing to acknowledge and embrace it. And I remember the first time that I really, aside from being required to do therapy for my degree, that the first time I actually sought out counseling services is when I felt like, okay, if I go inside of myself this time, I might not come back out. And that was a fear for myself, because it's like you can only take so much. What do you think is that line, Terry, between going inside and trying to deal with it, as some of us may do quite well? So where's that thin line between going outside of yourself?
What? I'm sorry, just say the last part again. What's the thin line?
Yeah, if there's a thin line between withdrawing to process information yourself, you know, to get in touch, you know, with your soul,
right,
and your spiritual being, and not dealing with the outside. But I think there's a line between that and going so far in that you can't connect with the outside world.
Mm.
What would you say?
Well, that's a really important point and question. I think it's a matter of, I'm struggling with this one just a little bit, because I'm trying to think about my own experience, which is why it's, I think, always important to have good, strong people in your life who know you, because sometimes you might go a little bit further than you should that is healthy for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so so you have people in your life who are mirrors and who can tell you what they're seeing. And that phrase, the Homeland Security thing, that if you see something, say something, I've been blessed to have people in my life who will tell me that I don't seem like myself, and I might be thinking that I'm okay that day. But I'm always interested in people's perceptions, because I think I'm moving through the world one way, and then I find out something completely different. Like the therapist that I've been going to for the better part of like maybe 2 years now, I was asking her for an appointment, and she responded, and I responded back. And then she said to me that she hoped I was okay, because I wasn't sounding like myself in the email. And I thought that was interesting, because I was like, wow, because I was being short differently.
Okay.
So she just felt something, and I was like, you know, you're absolutely right. I'm not my best self today. And so I just didn't know that how I was feeling was coming across in my emails, but I was exhausted, a lot of stress right through here, and so it was, excuse me, I'm sorry, just yawning a little bit, please forgive that. But
yes, it's late here on the East Coast.
And I myself can sometimes I will receive an email from someone, and I will, you can, I think it's interesting how you can tell how people are sometimes if you pay attention just by their emails, not even just the sound of their voice. There's something different about the way that they are communicating. I can feel real joy and energy sometimes with people that I don't really know that well. It just comes through the email. But I just, you know, as I said, it's an interesting question, and sometimes I know that I'm down and out and need to not be around other people, and other times I'm not quite sure unless somebody points it out to me, and then I have to take a look at what it is that they're seeing, you know?
It's interesting, and I'm going to let you share, you know, your story from the beginning when you first realized that you needed to seek outside help. But it's interesting that you would say that, because you know, I can talk to count the times that you and I have actually spoken, you know, probably on less than one hand. But through your emails, I usually can tell. And your emails, and occasionally I've been prompted just to send you a different note because I know you're a busy person, but there's a difference between busy and a difference between, you know, needing to, you know, sort of like guard yourself, but I could tell you make an extra effort to reach out just to connect, but if there's a different type there. So I'm just, it's interesting that you would say that. So when you first decided that you needed to get some services, you were also in the mental health field and you were doing your public relations and getting awards and everything. What was it that prompted you to seek help for your depression?
Well, the first time that I knew something was wrong was when I was in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that something was wrong because I was in my room sleeping a lot with the shades drawn. And I had little energy. I something isn't right here. And so that was what made me decide. And I'm kind of, as I talk about this right now, I'm kind of proud of the fact that I knew something was wrong because I didn't tell anybody. I mean, I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell them. I just knew that I needed some help. And I went to two different therapists, both of whom I liked as individuals, but I never heard the diagnosis depression, like never heard it. Mm-hmm. And with the second person that I was dealing with, I don't know, I was referred to her by my general practitioner. And all of a sudden, I just became aware. This just, I thank God for this like sixth sense or something. I said, now, how come I haven't been diagnosed with anything? And how come nobody, like my general practitioner and my therapist, never talked or connected about possibly medication? And so I had a conversation with my therapist, and then she told me that there's a psychopharmacologist that she could refer me to. But I was, it's really, oh boy, this is kind of, I don't know, this conversation is bothering me right now because I even feel a little bit emotional as I'm talking about it because I feel like I was abandoned on some level.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's like
mm-hmm.
with this, the therapist that I have now, she has her master's and when she works with patients that who either request or she thinks that they might need medication, there's an RN that she works with who you meet with her separately about, you know, what's going on and what might be the right kind of medication. And so if I do have an issue, the two of them, you know, collaborate and they work hand in hand. But it really bothered me that nowhere along the line did those two people communicate and kind of see how I was really doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really weird. I'm just having this, like, flashback. Mm. But that was the first time. And when I was in, when I couldn't get out of the bed for about 9 months, I had a breakdown maybe about seven years ago. All I did was work. I started this, you know, incredibly successful public relations firm. It wasn't just all of the pain that I inherited from my parents, both of whom their fathers abandoned their families. Just a lot of pain, not a lot of hugging or tenderness when I was growing up. Certainly you didn't talk about things that bothered you. My mom's brother my mother's brother was killed in a twin brother was killed in a car accident when they were 28. She didn't mourn his death for 22 years. She was molested by an older brother, and those were things that I would come to find out later really had an impact on me. But I was profoundly depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to a therapist who I really had great affection and respect for, she's the one who really kind of turned things around for me, because I was just working. I was going to events, but I wasn't feeling these events. And so I would cancel my appointments sometimes just before it was time to go, or I would come late. And after a couple months of this, she said to me, it seems to me like it would be more important for you to come here and heal yourself than to go to those events and be a fraction of who you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And when she said that to me, it was like, oh, you know, she just called me out. Because I was going to those events, and I wasn't even there.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she said that, that was the beginning of turning my life around, that I committed to therapy. I was with her for a year and a half, and then she moved to New Orleans, tried to do it by phone, but that didn't work. But she really set me in place to really work on my healing. I would say that's to really, really work on my healing. It was really a blessing to, you know, to have worked with her. And I'm very, very grateful to her. Her name was Denise Shervington, and I was just very grateful for her straightening me out. And now there is absolutely, positively nothing that ever gets in the way of my therapy appointments, because it's like that's how I breathe.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I breathe. But
exhale.
Huh?
I said that's how you exhale.
Yes, exactly. And you know what? When I go, I have this feeling sometimes of sadness for people who don't have that experience and don't know what it can do for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and it's a safe place. Something that you said, I think, you know, as you described your interaction with her, she touched your heart. She touched your soul. She got down in there deep. She just pricked it a little bit to say, I see you in there. And I think that's possibly what happens when we're going through these moments of depression and detachment, that no one knows really who I really am underneath all of this. People look at my accomplishments, my achievements, they listen to my words, but they don't really know who I am. And she touched you and said, I know you. And I often think that if we all had friends who understood us, our family members who took the time, that aside from some of the biochemical things that are going on, you know, organically in our bodies that contribute to the different mental disorders, that whole thing of depression really comes from a place of aloneness. And Cheryl, you mentioned, you know, being lonely, and I think there's a difference between being lonely and being alone. However, but that sense of being connected, that sense of being nurtured and cared for, a place and a time that's just your own, it's very rare that people in our society even get that. And what's so sad is even our babies aren't getting that anymore. And that's why it's so important. And I want to talk about how to get for people to determine if the help that they're seeking is right for them. I know people said, well, I tried it and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. I remember going to a therapist, leaving one day and sitting in my car crying for an hour. And then I stopped and looked up just out the clip and said, well, I'm sitting here crying. I just paid this lady just to talk to, and I'm feeling worse when I came out. And I had to go inside and figure out, okay, what is happening that I'm not feeling any better, because I wasn't connecting with this person. And I had to realize her style did not suit me. She did not understand me. Part of it was cultural. Mm-hmm. You know, as an African-American female, she just could not relate. I spent half of my time, you know, trying to describe to her, translate what I was saying, and I don't even talk much Ebonics. And she just didn't get it. So I think that is very important. And the other thing I wanted to say, because I know we had a couple of listeners on who are not of African-American ethnicity, and to talk about what is unique about the issue of mental health and mental illness in the African-American community.
And what do you mean in terms of unique?
what makes it a primary area of concern for us?
Well, if I could just say, well, two things I would like to say. One is when you mentioned that people, you've heard people say, well, you know, I tried a therapist once and then they just stopped going. What my response to that is always like, you know, you don't stop wearing shoes if the first pair don't fit, you know? You keep trying on shoes until you find a pair that fit. And so it's a relationship. But I think the things that are unique to our community, is that what your question was? What was the question again?
What makes it of primary importance to us in the African-American community? Why do we find it important to address this particular program to issues related to mental health in the African-American community?
Well, I would say that to be a person of color in this country means that you have to be 10 times better than our white counterparts, for instance. You might have the exact same credentials, but you have to work so much harder to get to where many of our white counterparts get. Have to be 10 times better than. I also think that as a person of color, we move through the world in a way that says that you don't matter. Almost at every turn, especially in the inner cities, it's like you just don't matter. People mm-hmm. either look right through you or they're intimidated by you. Young brothers, I think, really, really have it hard. Brothers in general, I mean, women, we all do as human beings. But I think it's a lot tougher for black boys and black men. You know, they're always in danger of being shot down by either one of their own or police officers. If you are a dark-skinned black man, maybe tall with a booming voice, you are someone who is very intimidating to other people. I had a number of brothers tell me, and I spoke about a bit of this in Black Pain, that these brothers who worked in corporate America, if they were big, tall, and especially dark-skinned and had booming voices, they started to soften their voice, smile extra, stand differently so that they were not as intimidating to other people. And just because you become used to changing who you are when you go to work doesn't mean that it, just because it's second nature to you, doesn't mean that it takes something out of you every time you do that. Okay. Then if you don't go to therapy, don't have anywhere to get rid of that stuff, release your anger and whatever about that, then you end up going home and taking it out on somebody who doesn't deserve it, do you know? Mm-hmm. But I think there's so many things that happen to us. There's so many slights. When you look at our communities, I live in an area of New York, Westchester County, that has some rather lovely apartments that are right on the water. But two blocks away, there is so much despair in the faces of our people there. And there's a supermarket there that I know does not have the same quality of vegetables and fruits that they don't have the same quality of product and fruits, et cetera, or service than the store that is just about 20 blocks away where mm-hmm. they're not many of us. But we get second-class education, second-class stores, second-class everything. So it's like you just feel like you don't matter.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's something else that you said when you talk about, you know, the intimidation factor. But I think when you also look at depression, you know, I say I went to school, but I didn't subscribe to all of the psychological jargon and determinations and definitions. However, but the whole issue of depression being anger turned inside just rings so true to me and resonates for me. But I think the other part of that is when we look that the anger and the violence, especially amongst our young people, that is also a symptom of depression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that people, that the anger that's inside is a lot of times misplaced anger because of all of the things. And when you look at generationally, you talked about the issue, you know, with your parents and the dynamics of what had gone on in your mom's life that spread onto yours. Those are things that we aren't even aware of that are instilled in us from day to day. This week, actually tomorrow, will be 5 years ago that my mother passed. And just recently, her first cousin had a stroke. And so her sister came from Louisiana, and she was in the house with me. And it just hit me just so strong that a lot of the things that I saw in my mother that I thought were her issues with me were really issues just passed down from her from the family ties and from the generation. And it was
yep.
like a wake-up call to me. It was almost leery, but as I looked at this cousin who had a very strong physical resemblance to my mother, I listened to the tone of her speech. I listened to her words, and I was able to look at them from a slightly different perspective, words that otherwise wounded me. But now I was able to stand outside from being in a different relationship and see that this is just part of where they came from as a family, and just the pain that they bore. It's like, wow, and I got some of that too. But I also realized now through therapy, through my own just self-awareness, realizing I don't have to succumb to that mindset. It's just amazing. So part of it's educating our community and our young people about what belongs to them and what doesn't, and who they really are, that they do deserve attention, that they do have value, that there are strengths, and there is hope. And that sense of hope
yes.
is what we really want to impart, because that was what you indicated in your statement, which I believe to hold to be true, is that caused Don Cornelius to take his own life. There was a sense that there was no hope, there was nothing else worth living. And when we talk about mental illness, we talk about, one, the threat of danger to yourself or someone else. So in Cheryl, you were talking about your mom becoming violent and aggressive towards others. I'm not sure if she ever self-inflicted any injuries to herself. But then when we talk about depression, we're more concerned about people inflicting harm upon themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Any experience with that for either of you?
Oh, with my mom, she tried to cut her wrist and stick her head in the oven. And then one time with me, at the little town that I grew up in, there were railroad tracks, and we were coming back from somewhere, and my mother wanted to jump. And she was with me, and she just said, you know, we should jump. And I just kept saying, okay, because I really wasn't really sure what to say. And we were walking over this long overpass, and so she said, do you think we should jump? And I just started saying, I'll tell you when we should jump. And so I waited till we got all the way down to the bottom of the hill, and I said, okay, now we can jump. And we just stepped down, and we were on solid ground.
He just looked
oh,
at me.
Oh, my gosh.
And
wow.
I was, you know, still a youngster and stuff. So that was pretty. But, you know, it's amazing because I have so many wild experiences with my mother, but I never just remember feeling afraid of her. I was never afraid of her. I just operated. I just functioned. I just did just whatever needed to be done. But it was never any fear about her or any of the situations, because whatever was going on, you know, I was the fixer, so I could always fix everything. So with her, that was that was pretty interesting. But I also too, I just think in terms of mental health, that we still, just in terms of talking about it, it's still such a taboo. Because if you think about it, right now, we're in a society where we talk about everything. You know, we can talk about AIDS, we can talk about, you know, gay and lesbians, we could talk about, you know, the president. I mean, we talk about everything. It's like that commercial that I was sharing with you the other day, Evelyn. We ask all these different questions about, you know, how are you going to serve it? You know, does this come in size 8? And, you know, what color does this, and how much does this cost? But when we get to the doctor's office, we don't have any questions. And so mental health is kind of like that. We can talk about everybody and they mama and what's going on next door, but when it comes to how are we feeling, we don't talk about that, because the society says that the polite thing to do is ask, well, how are you doing? And what do we say? I'm fine. But really, we got chaos. We're in shambles. We're falling apart. We're just barely holding on, you know. And so we don't talk about that because we haven't been conditioned to really talk about that. And we still don't want to discuss mental health. I just think about having seminars, and Terry, I just want to thank you. When I had my first seminar, and I reached out to you, and you donated your wonderful books, and I said, this lady doesn't even know me, but you're willing to do that. And so that's one thing I really appreciate about you. But just in terms of getting people to come, we'll pay $175 to go see my girl Anita Baker, but to come and hear me talk about mental health and the impact and signs and symptoms of depression and what we can do to better ourselves, people want to start bargaining with me about the price tag. You know, so we don't want to talk about it. We shy from it. It's still not a place of comfort for us even today. It's just not there. But I'm so proud of
you. You're right, but I think that we can, I mean, I know because of the work that we've been doing over the last several years, is that I can't even, every single day we're getting requests for therapists, referrals for therapists, because when we talk about it, and I mean, I talk about, you know, just my experience in therapy, I sometimes will share certain things, or I found out, like, about the source of some of my anger issues. I'm very, very transparent because, and the reason I can be, the reason I could tell you that I have anger issues is because I know everybody out here in the audience has them. And can you let me know I'm not by myself and watch people's hands go up. But when you are truly, and the reason that I'm able to do it, the reason that I was able to talk about my breakdown and the medication is because I know it's you too. Everybody's walking that fine line of, forgive the use of the word, but everybody's walking that fine line of crazy. You know what I'm saying? And so we have to normalize it. We really do. I spoke at a church one day, and this preacher said to me afterwards, we were having a conversation about, because he was very moved by something that I said or did or whatever, and he said, you know what I'm going to do from now on? My part is that in my sermons, I'm going to say when I was in my when I was with my therapist. That's what we have to begin to do, so that it doesn't seem like it's something that's so, like, unusual and shouldn't be talked about. I know many of my white friends have, you know, and colleagues, they will tell you unasked what antidepressants they're on. They will tell you they can't come to a staff meeting because they're going to where? To see their therapist. Meanwhile, if we do go, we lie about where we're going. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's I know that we, at the Stay Strong Foundation, I know that we're making a difference because of the letters that we get every day and the requests for therapists in different parts of the country. And we have a wellness program. It's really pretty local right now in New York, but we have a list of therapists who have agreed to donate X number of hours to some of the people who reach out to us, give them that to give them the experience of what a therapeutic session is, and to see if something can be worked out with them, in, you know, in that regard.
And to take away the mystery, the fear, and the stigma. It's interesting that you talked about, you know, people of European descent talking about their therapy appointments. And I remember one of my colleagues who had sent one of her relatives' children to me, and she said, you know, I don't know who this girl thinks she is now. She tells me, you know, without any hesitation, oh, I can't go to that day. This is the day to go. I go to my therapist. But we were laughing at it because it was so refreshing, as opposed to most of the kids, those who are having ordered to come through the courts or through social services, to know that this is a privilege and not a punishment.
That's right.
Yeah. That is important. And I think the other part that you shared is that when we're talking, we're not talking from a theoretical point of view. We're talking from a personal point of view. When you're sharing your experiences as opposed to teaching or lecturing, that's something different because everybody wants to feel like, okay, you're talking about me. You're allowing me and you're teaching me how to talk about me to make it personal. And I think that's what you do so very well, Terry. And one of the exercises
Thank you. I recall you
doing at a conference was where I think just putting a topic in a bag and someone pulling it out and just reading from it. And without any variance, practically everyone who came forth just to read what was on that paper, it didn't have to be about them, but they had a story to tell about what was on that paper that brought them and everybody in the room to tears because it was something that they could relate to because when they read it, it was, I guess, to be in the third person, but it became about them. Whereas if you had asked them those questions, they probably would never, ever had disclosed that information.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just finding a way to make people feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in time for us in closing. I would like for each of you, I want to thank you because there's so much. I still feel like we just covered the, you know, just touched the surface of a lot of this. But hopefully some of our listeners have been compelled to be able to reach out to share your own stories, to relieve some of the your own burden or stress or fears, and also to be able to help someone else to be able to go seek the help and the attention that they need. But I want to leave everyone with resources, and also, Cheryl, I know that you are also seeking participants in your research for your dissertation. Can you tell our listeners how they might be able to participate that and what the criteria is?
Well, the criteria is simply someone who's like me, someone who lived in the environment, doesn't have to be your mother, but whoever your primary caretaker was, and that person was diagnosed with a mental illness, and of course, be African-American and 18 and over. And so what I'm looking for is, because so many people that you run into, they, when you ask the question, you know, is there any mental health history in your background? And they say, well, I know my mama crazy. I said, but has she been diagnosed, girl? You know, so we all have those kind of folks in our background. But what I'm really specifically looking for is if you have someone that you grew up with and they were actually diagnosed with a mental illness, and that could be anything, schizophrenic or bipolar or depression, so anything, or dual diagnosis in terms of they have one diagnosis, but they also have some type of substance abuse, alcohol, or drugs. And so I'm looking for participants to join my study, and it is just a one-time, one-on-one interview. It depends on how long you talk. It could be 30 minutes. It could be an hour. But so if you are interested in doing that, and also you will have your choice of selecting a $25 gift card. And I just pick up different various things so you can select what you would like. So I am still looking for that, male or females. Right? You know, I got a lot of women signing up, but my men are kind of reluctant to get in there and voice and share their experiences. But that is what I am looking for. And so please feel free to call me and contact me.
Okay, will you give them the contact information and the deadline by which you need them to contact you?
This whole month. So I want to wrap things up at the end of February. And my number is area code 707-557-8622. And it is confidential. Your name will not be in the study. I'm just taking information and give you have 5 questions to ask and just give you a chance to respond. So your name's not going to show up in there in the study. You don't have to worry about that. It's all confidential.
Okay. Can you repeat your number one more time and perhaps even an email address?
707-557-8622. My email is NACN as in Nancy Mims at AOL.com.
That's NANACNM
at AOL.com. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. And Terry, tell us about what some of the resources that you and your organization and the other connections that you're involved with are offering for our community.
Well, you know, I would encourage people to go to our website, www.thestaystrongfoundation.org. There are resources. You'll see some very, very powerful videos of people who are sharing their stories, brothers and sisters on the street. There's a place in California called Calabasas, which is like one of the wealthiest communities in California, in the United States, where there were 10 suicides last year alone.
Hmm.
So it's like pain, depression does not discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd encourage people to go to that website and see, and if they would like to make a donation to help us to continue the work, we would appreciate that. And also to check out some other stories on www.storiesthatheal.samhsa, S as in Sam, A, M as in Mary, H, S as in Sam, A, .gov, storiesthatheal.samhsa.gov. And I think people will be moved by what they see. And
yes.
I will also just say that I was blessed. I went through the fire, came out on the other side, and was blessed to write a book that's changing a lot of people's lives, Black Pain. It just looks like we're not hurting. I suggest get the book by any means necessary. Go to the library, go to a bookstore, but it will change your life. You'll see everybody you know in there, you'll see yourself in there, because we are all the same. T.D. Jakes loved the book. In fact, when I spoke at his conference last year, he said, if there are any white people out there, you get the book too, just cross out Black and write White Pain.
Okay. I just crossed out the letter, period, just said Pain.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah,
indeed.
There you go.
Yes. And
okay.
I
want to just say, I really enjoyed this, Cheryl. It was just amazing to hear you speak and to share about your experience. This was a really great show. I just was very moved by your testimony.
Oh, thank you. I don't know if you're thinking of me or not. But
thank you both so much.
Okay.
This is something special, and I think the fact that we had already planned to do this prior to, you know, the news of Darn Cornelius' suicide, and it just shows us what the timing is. And I also want to say, Terry, that my story didn't make your book, but my name did. I tell people, I forgot the page number now, but I tell people, I said, if you look at page such and such such, you look right down on the slide and you'll see my name. And I'm also pleased, you know, that you are also one of the people who wrote the foreword for my book, It's Hard Work Being the Village That Raises a Child. And I just thank you for that, because I definitely believe that we have a kindred spirit. And I know that even beyond now, there is something that's probably in store for us all to be able to work together, and especially your work with the young people. And there's a website also that I saw. It's You Too, You Me Too. What is the website that's geared towards the young people?
It can be accessed through the Stay Strong Foundation, but it's called Used to Be Me.
Used to be me.net.
USED, the number 2, then BE, then ME.net. Used to be me.net.
Yes, and please go to that, and especially, you know, for those who know me, my heart is really with our young people, because they are us in a few years. Sometimes they're already us, but, as, you know, the quote says that our children are 30 to 40% of our population, but 100% of our future, and they need us. They need us so much, and there's a lot that we can learn from them as well. Pardon me?
No, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to say you are so right, and I really love and appreciate who you are in the world in terms of our youth. I think we do our young people a great injustice when we don't tell them who we are, what our struggles
mm-hmm.
are. We're always trying to be perfect and pretend like everything is fine, but kids see us,
okay.
You know? If they live with us, work with us, or go to school with us, it's not like they can't tell that we're, you know, a bit off. They know.
Mm-hmm.
But they will tell you we do lie to them,
mm-hmm.
trying to quote unquote protect them, when in fact we're setting them up for like a lifetime of emotional distress. But when you tell a kid who you really are, what your challenge has been, and how you've come through the fire, they will tell you anything.
Yes.
Because they know you're the real deal.
And I know that's for sure. People, you know, tend not to want to share because, one, they don't want their power or authority to be undermined with the kids, and what they don't know is just the total opposite, because there's a respect.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, one of the things that happens, you know, the kids, they look at you and they say, for real? Yeah. It's like fulfill. And they say, oh, and they're ready to go then. The other part is sometimes we don't want to place that burden on them. We don't want to switch roles and parentify their roles in our lives, but they definitely need to know. And the beautiful part of that for me is it's our young people, some of my young people who've spoken back into my life in a day that I've been off and just reminded me of what I've said, and they give me to know. They actually
yes,
know.
Yes, yes.
My thing is like, excuse me? Who told you that? And we'll just bust out laughing. But that's also rewarding to know that they've taken and internalized the words, the message, and the life that we've given them, and they're able to give back to us. And it's a reciprocal
that's
relationship,
right,
which also gives them a sense of purpose and value. So
yep,
we can go on and on and on. I think of you. I know you have other things to do. You're still out healing the world. I know it's after 10 o'clock there in New York, but thank you so much, Ms. Terry, for your time.
It's been my pleasure.
Yes, and we shall do something more again. Let us know when you're going to be back in California. Thank you, Sister Cheryl, and good luck on the rest of your dissertation. And the next time you're on this program, you'll be Dr. Cheryl. Okay, good night, everyone, and God bless. And I guess I should add my information on. I am Evelyn Polk, licensed marriage family therapist. My email address is Ms.E@fourchildsheart.com or me@talktomisse.com. And my phone number is 707-553-1971. So everyone, take care, God bless, and do something not only for a child's heart, but for the heart of your inner child. Good night and God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
From the tears she cried, she cried, she cried.